market.
The S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that's among the 1,000 most respected podcasts in the country, at least we think. I'm Andrew Page, and with me, as always, is Mr. Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools. I think that's because there's 999 podcasts, Andrew.
We're in the top 1,000, and that's what counts. And the reason we say that is because Barron's has made a list of America's most respected companies. Who are they, and do we care? Also, how accountants can cause huge losses. Well, in fact, that's what they've done for the retailers. We take a closer look at that. And finally, the barbarians are coming for Vocus.
What, the rugby team?
The private equity barbarians.
Okay. Different barbarians.
A whole different kettle of fish.
Mind you, plenty of rugby players end up in investment banking, so that might be no different.
That's very true, actually.
Shall we move on?
But let's move on.
All right.
So, Barron's.
Yes, the storied, respected US business publication, closest to probably, for those older listeners who remember BRW, it's about as close as Australia gets to Barron's. BRW, of course, sadly no longer other than online.
Yep.
But Barron's is the most respected, longest running, storied business magazine in the country.
Yep.
And it's named the most respected companies, the most respected American companies,
mm-hmm.
Just recently.
Now, before we go through the list here, and we're not going to go through the 100 of them.
Starting from number 100, that's right. Welcome to the countdown.
We're not going to do that.
This is the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast, after
that's
all.
That's right.
Counting down the 100 most respected companies in America.
How did they define respected?
Well, here's the great thing about these lists. They asked a whole lot of investors.
Okay.
And they got them to rank them. For every company, they said, is it very respected, respected, neutral, not respected, or particularly not respected?
That was it.
Yeah, 5-point scale.
They didn't do, okay.
Will it give you a company name? Yeah, tick a box, and we'll see who comes up with the most votes.
All right, okay. So number one was Alphabet.
Drum roll.
Alphabet. Well, Alphabet, for those playing along at home, is the parent company of Google, which was rebadged not too long ago.
You know what, as a pet hate of mine, is corporate rebrandings and corporate renamings.
Yeah.
This one particularly is just stupid. But anyway, let's move on.
Yeah, that's a whole podcast episode right there, which we might come back to.
And our listeners are now saying, no, for the love of God, don't spend 25 minutes talking about rebranding.
So Google came in number one. Apple came in number two.
Yes. A shout out to the new advisor of Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities, Anirban Mahanti, who's probably listening to this.
The biggest Apple fanboy that ever walked the earth.
Indeed. By a decent margin,
yeah,
just quietly.
Oh, my God. We love you, Doc.
We do.
Next was Amazon.
Now, that's something I can get behind.
That's really rocketed up the list in recent years.
Plus, I'm a shareholder, so I like it.
So you can promote that.
I
think you're probably going to be a fan of number four, which is Berkshire Hathaway.
There we go.
Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger.
Only three places lower than it deserves to be, Andrew.
And finally, we've got Mr. Gates with Microsoft at number five. Now, the interesting thing about the list here is that four of the five here are technology companies.
Yeah.
I guess Amazon's probably you could classify that in a number of different ways, but technology obviously very important.
Technology enabled, yes, absolutely.
And so that was interesting. That's definitely a sign of the times here. Frankly, though, I would have thought if it comes to respect, and again, obviously we're Buffett fanboys and all the rest of it, but all of that aside, you would have thought that Berkshire would have had to be closer to the top of the list. For a bunch of reasons, right? In terms of corporate responsibility and what they've done and everything like that, you'd have to think that they deserve more respect than Google, for example.
What do I think about this year's list, Andrew? I'm glad you asked.
Right.
Pushing off the sideboard. There's a couple of things about this list. The first is, by the way, it used to be the world's most respected companies.
Yeah, right. Is that the World Series baseball?
Well, no, it was literally the world.
Okay.
This year it's just American companies.
Oh, okay. I'm
reluctant to draw a parallel between that and the new foreign policy of the United States, won't. But
don't do that.
But you could make that link. Secondly, to your point, you ask investors which companies have most respect. The answer is almost universally going to be, well, the ones that have gone up,
that have made me money, for God's sake.
Yeah. Exactly. So you think about and these are probably five of the top, I'm going to say 10 highest valued companies on the U.S. stock market.
Certainly, ones that have created incredible shareholder value.
Ask yourself, isn't it just probable that one of the top five most respected companies in the US is not one of the biggest 10.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So realistically, when we say respected, it sounds good. Barron's get a nice headline. The investors get to feel good about, and this, they ask the investment professionals for these rankings. Really what you're seeing, I reckon you can start with the top 20 companies in the US. You take out the ones that either they don't like or that have bad corporate reputation. There's no oil companies there. There's no banks. There's no,
tobacco.
Right. Yeah. So the ones that are exciting, that are interesting, that everyone loves, that have gone up a lot, and you kind of end up with roughly this list, right? Buffett makes the list because some people on the voting panel clearly remember that he'd done this for 55 years and been extraordinarily successful and deserves it for his corporate leadership as well as his results, I should say. But looking at the rest of the list, I don't have a problem with any of those companies. They are very, very worthy of our respect.
Totally.
But it's also worth saying, quite frankly, these are just the biggest and the ones that have got up the most. And look, you know, on one level, that does mean we should give them an element of respect. Are they the most respected just because of that? Well, it kind of depends who you ask.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Then we move on to more interesting topics. Yes. But if you had to create a list, I'm not going to ask you to create a list of 100 here, but just what would you class what would you class as the most respected company on the ASX?
You know, this is a bit like the RBA. You know when people say, what will the RBA do and what should the RBA do? Right. They're kind of two different questions, yes, right? So if you said to me, which companies in the ASX would other people say are the most respected versus which ones do I think?
Right.
I think you'd get a different list. I think if I was going to make a list, I value longevity and I value long-term performance.
Yes.
So you think about some of the big long-term success stories, the Soul Patts, the Wesfarmers,
the companies
that have been around for a very long time that have done a really good job, even the Woolworths of the world, after the most recent kind of, you know, share price wobbles and frankly business performance wobbles, the business that is Woolies over the last 30 or so years has been a really strong success story. And so the ones that have made great things of themselves, they would definitely rank up there.
Yeah. I give a shout out to a couple of the healthcares, Cochlear and CSL, I think of just such huge Australian success stories internationally, which we don't often do that well at.
Correct.
And they're doing good as well.
We're kind of falling back to which are most successful, right? And this is always the challenge, we're thinking about which are the most successful companies. And look, that deserves some respect. But you also might say, well, which companies, maybe the ones that deserve respect are the ones with the highest levels of corporate social responsibility, or the ones that have invented the products or services that have done the most good, or the ones whose corporate leadership, you know, speak or support the right or best causes. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. I think to your point, I would add Westfield to that list in terms of international success stories.
That's true.
Some of the homegrown businesses, and frankly, there's some not on the ASX, which is not really our purview, but also those businesses that have been built to great things. And so we're kind of prone to thinking about respect in terms of success, and that's logical. That's what we do, and our scorecard tends to be share price and profit. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. I think those are the ones I'd probably put in that list.
I give a couple here, and I would nominate a couple of these companies purely because of their extreme shareholder friendliness.
Yep.
One is a company called ARB. They make bull bars. You would have seen that, you know, sort of four-wheel drive accessories. Indeed. And I say that because the Brown brothers sort of founded this company. They pay themselves a very small salary. Yep. They've got huge amounts of shares. There's no dilution. They run it in an extraordinarily shareholder-friendly way. And as it turns out, shareholders have done phenomenally well. They're a very, very well-run company. Another very small company many people wouldn't have heard of is 1-300-SMILES. They aggregate dental practices of all things. But again, very shareholder-friendly leader at the top there, which I think deserves special mention because unfortunately, not many companies are shareholder friendly these days, so I give them a shout out.
Yeah, look, I'll have one. This is the question, right? We're now framing respect as shareholder friendliness,
right?
That's very reasonable.
How you frame it, yeah.
In terms of that, I'm going to throw one for my biggest shareholding and one that's done well for us at Share Advisor, which is corporate travel management.
Oh, I had to mention those guys.
Jamie Ferris at the business done a really, really good job, and when they've done capital raisings, they've done fair capital raisings for everybody, which is incredibly, incredibly uncommon.
Yeah.
But should be replicated by more companies. So again, in terms of shareholder friendliness, if that's our version of respect, then I think those companies, as you say, Andrew, ARB, 1-300-SMILES, and corporate travel definitely deserve some plaudits for doing a great job there.
Mate, I'm going to give a bit of a shameless plug here at the moment. You mentioned the service that you run.
I do.
We've been doing the podcast for a while.
Yes.
Over a year. Yeah, over a year
for
now.
For those people who are keeping listeners.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
For mum and your mum who's listening, thanks
That's
for being with us.
Both of our listeners have really enjoyed it
really
so far.
Enjoyed it. How do people get involved in Share Advisor?
I'm glad you asked, Andrew.
You like that?
Yeah, I do like that. That's good. Almost seamless. People wouldn't realise we're trying to give ourselves a plug here. So that's Motley Fool Share Advisor.
Yeah.
And Andrew's service, Motley Fool Dividend Investor. Both very high quality services. I recommend them both heartily. Go to fool.com.au/MMM. You can sign up to our free newsletter, so it doesn't cost you a cent. You will get some marketing opportunities to join both of those services. But if you want to get a taste of what the Motley Fool is about, our boss, Bruce Jackson, writes a very entertaining and very readable newsletter. You get a couple of times a week, and then you can choose if you want to sign up to Motley Fool Share Advisor or Dividend Investor. Thanks for asking, Andy.
Done like a true champion.
Didn't even notice that
you'll,
was a plug today.
You'll be on Oprah next doing the same thing.
You get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car.
Yeah, that's right.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's let's talk about accountant.
From the sublime to the ridiculous. Oh, there you go.
So let's talk about accounting. Oh, so can we have to talk about it because during the week,
a whole
range of retailers got knocked. Well, the retailers, we've talked a lot about retailers. Yeah. We're not going to pick at that same scab again, except in this sort of, the angle that sort of captured attention is that there's a change, an upcoming change to the accounting rules, which has
that seen... clicking sounds, everyone cancelling the podcast. Oh, quick, next.
God, tell me all about the accounting rules, Andrew.
Give me to Roy and HG, quick.
Well, it's kind of relevant because it saw some very substantial share price falls throughout the week. RFG, probably one of the biggest ones. These are the guys, retail. They're a master franchiser. They do Michelle's Patisserie, Donut King, Gloria Jean's,
Brumby's Bakery,
Pizza Capers,
Crust.
Yeah. Whole bunch of stuff. For the record, I'm a fan. They're a recommendation of ours. They've done very well for shareholders over the years. We think that'll continue to be the case. But share price down a massive 10%.
About 11.
11% on the day. It's come back a little bit. But wow, that's many, many, many millions of dollars of valuation wiped out. So what the accountants basically said was, we need you guys to account for operating leases. In fact, we need these to be treated as a liability, we want you to put on the balance sheet.
The clicking stopped, the snoring started, dude. Come on. Help me out here.
So what does that mean? Hot potato, boom, there you go.
All right, don't hang up. Don't turn us off. Stay with us, fools, because this is a really important thing to understand. What happens is a company can have two different types of leases, and we're not going to go into accounting chicanery, so stick with us. One lease says you have a liability. You have a debt on the balance sheet for the value of that lease. That's a financial lease or a capital lease. The other one's called an operating lease, and you have to recognize the cost of that, but not the liability. So you think about two different things. If you've got a loan to the bank, you have an amount of money you owe the bank, a couple hundred grand for a house, that's your liability. Mm-hmm. If you're a renter, you don't really have a liability in the same sense. You just have a rental expense. Mm. And that's the way these two different leases have been treated.
Yep.
What's going to happen in a couple of years' time is the rules will change. And so every lease you have must be recorded as a liability. Mm. So for those companies that have a balance sheet that looks okay now, all of a sudden, all of those liabilities are going to drop on that balance sheet.
So at the moment, they are what you call off-balance sheet items.
Correct.
Which tends to have a bit of a stink around it post-Enron and the rest of it. It sounds very shady and the rest of it. And often it is very shady. But they're going to bring them on balance sheet. So all of a sudden, things like return on capital metrics aren't going to be as good. Leverage metrics are going to look a little bit worse.
Yep. So debt goes up. Returns on that debt will fall. Mm. If you're looking only at those metrics, things will look bad. On the flip side, by the way, profit will probably improve because you're not got that operating lease cost on the balance sheet anymore, on the P&L anymore. So it
becomes
kind of
depreciation cost.
Right. Now, shares fell 10% for Retail Food Group or 11%. They fell a whole lot for some other retailers as well because the accountants just put a number on a different line.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing? And
amazing is very kind, mate. This is stone motherless stupid.
Well, I happened to be on the telly that day, and they said, "Andrew, what does this mean?" And I was like, "It seems oversimplistic." It was like nothing. It doesn't. The fact of the matter is, the company RFG we were talking about before is the same company today as it was yesterday, as it was last week.
Yep.
The amount of lease that they had to pay was always going to be the same.
Yep.
It was always there and disclosed within the notes to the financial statements anyway, to a large degree.
And it makes not a cent of difference to the cash flow provided by that company.
All the risk.
Yeah.
You know, nothing. So on that hand, I sort of say it's bubkus. On the other hand, I say, well, look, anything that brings greater accountability and greater transparency to the financial statements, I think is a good thing. I'm all for that. And often, you know, you need to go, perhaps things go a little bit too far, but if it just means that everything's a little bit more tickety-boo, then I'm okay with all of that.
Tickety-boo and bubkus, dude.
You've been
in the thesaurus this week. I think that's, look, this is the stupidity of the market, right? Like, there is nothing different about Retail Food Group. There's nothing new known about Retail Food Group's business than what we knew last week.
Yeah.
And the shares fell 10% just because the accountants were changing how they were going to list some of the real realities of that business that we already knew.
Yeah. Well, I think some of the people thought, wait a sec, debt covenants will maybe be breached. You know, the lenders are not going to, they're going to realize there's much more debt there. I can't imagine any of these major banks are surprised by this. I mean, before they lend, give a $100 million debt facility to a company, not like they don't dig through all of it. They know full well what they're operating.
Well, they should, right? And quite frankly,
if they don't, for God's sake, help us all.
If you own shares in a bank that is surprised by Retail Food Group's change in accounts, you should sell those. You should go short those shares because that bank is going to be so woefully run that you need to do something about it.
The other thing is for this to be a genuine lie, you'd have to assume something like Woolies and Wesfarmers got caught up in this. So let's say that all the Coles are going to go are going to close their supermarkets, and that they're going to be on the hook to continue to pay the lease for these things. Their long-term leases could be another 5 years they're on the hook for paying. I mean, the probability of that happening is, you know, to use the lingo, a Six Sigma event or something like that, you know, like 1 in a billion trillion chance type stuff. So I think it's kind of, again, I'm all for the extra disclosure. Yep. It changes nothing in terms of the business operations, its potential, its cash flows, all that kind of stuff. Storm in a teacup.
Totally. And look, yes, madness. Absolute madness. Okay.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's tackle the final topic here. Let's
change gears.
And we're going to talk a bit about Vocus Telecommunications. Now, this has been in the news for really all the wrong reasons. And again, full disclosure, recommendation for us at Motley Fool Dividend Investor.
I wouldn't say the wrong reasons. Probably the right reasons as well, right?
Well, it depends how you want to peel that particular banana. And let's do that right now.
The barbarians are coming.
So the barbarians being?
KKR, Kohlberg Kravis Roberts.
The super massive private equity firm from the United States.
These guys wrote the book. These guys, they took over Nabisco, the biscuit company, way back in the day. Mm. The book is called Barbarians at the Gate, hence the barbarians reference we just made. These guys created effectively the old leverage buyout. For those who are a little bit older than maybe some of our younger listeners, the leverage buyout was kind of the first big takeover kind of strategy, right? It was unknown until that point.
Yeah.
And KKR, Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, created this whole idea. Spectacularly good book if you want to read it. They've been in business since then. It must be almost 30 years ago they started that.
Yeah.
And they are they've done
spectacularly well.
They really have.
And they're still able to prosecute the strategy because let's face it, a sucker's born every minute.
And they've birthed the whole heap of copycats, right? Private equity, I mean, look, if they hadn't done it, someone would have come up with the idea. But frankly, that playbook is now being embraced by private equity mobs right around the world.
So just to go into that playbook, just very quickly for those at home. So what you do is you borrow a ton load of money.
Yes.
You buy out a company.
Yes.
You strip out as many costs as you possibly can.
Yes.
You extract as much cash as you possibly can.
Yes.
You put a bit of lipstick on that pig and then you float it off to the market to a willing public who's happy to buy it and take the story. And so you end up walking away with $1 squillion.
You're a bitter, bitter man, Andrew.
That's just how it goes. I'm almost, there's not many black and white rules I have in investing, but one of them is probably closest is anything that's come out of private equity hands, I don't go near, at least for a couple of years until there's, you know, any skeletons that are in those closets can come out.
And quite frankly, current Meyer shareholders or former Dick Smith shareholders will know exactly how this feels.
Yeah, yeah. Dick Smith, great example.
Here's the great thing about leverage buyouts, right? You go and buy a company. Mm. You buy a company for $100, right? Yeah. Then what you do is you take on $85 worth of debt and you pay yourself an $85 dividend.
Yes.
So all of a sudden, you as the owner have made $85.
Yep.
The company's taken $85 worth of debt from the $100 worth of business that was already owned. Mm-hmm. Then you kind of just take a few costs out so you can sell it back to the market for $120 and you walk away.
So you win on multiple fronts there.
It's extraordinary. And look,
and frankly, where it's dangerous for the people who pick up the can at the end, or people who willingly buy into it, they've now got a much, much riskier business with a lot of the costs stripped out, often with a lot of necessary investments that have been put on ice. So there's a lot of CapEx requirements that coming down the pipeline. And just the nature of the high leverage, if there is any wobble within the business and you know, sales don't go in a straight line for even the best businesses in the world.
Yep.
It just means they're incredibly susceptible to something not going their way, and the business could fold, frankly. Yeah.
And I think, look, we should be a little bit clear here. This is not, you know, this is something that we shouldn't imply that PE is necessarily doing something awful or illegal or immoral or unethical. They're entitled to buy whatever assets are available on the market. Yeah. They're entitled to sell the assets to anyone who wants to buy them. Mm-hmm. They are simply saying, well, I'll buy that because it's cheap and I'll sell it back to someone else at a price I think is reasonable.
Yep.
And if they want to pay that price, then not good on it.
Yeah, and they'll say they're extracting value and improving efficiency.
And they're looking after their own shareholders, right? So, you know, and frankly, if we're in that same position, we might be tempted to do the same thing. The question here
just don't like it because we're not part of that party. is that what it is?
Look, I think there are some questions about information disadvantage, which is a broader market issue. Mm-hmm. If you're... You know, they bought Meyer for a song. They sold it back for a Mozart to relatively unsuspecting, or at least, you know, shareholders who probably should have or could have known better, but maybe had some sort of, it's not informational disadvantage, just a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding of the business. Dick Smith, exactly the same thing, right? Yeah. Came on the market, looked like a good deal. The business got an enormous cash flow troubles because of what had happened on the PE. Now, the PE guys are entitled to do that as long as there's no laws broken, and we don't believe there are in either case.
No.
There's no reason they can't do it. The question is it fair to the unsuspecting retail shareholder? Probably not, and that's probably a regulatory issue. But look, you know, PE are entitled to do it. They're allowed to do it. They're doing it legally and ethically, or at least so say the government. That's not unreasonable. But as you say, Andrew, that means absolutely the buyer should very much beware.
And they are doing so. Let's bring this back to yes. Vocus here. So Vocus, real share market darling, is phenomenal wealth creation, yep. incredible share price appreciation until over many, many, many years.
Wasn't.
And then it all started with TPG last year, sort of saying, "Oh, geez, you know, there's not as much growth as we thought. This transition to the NBN could hurt our margins." And so the market all of a sudden thought, oh my gosh, this aggregation play that was going on in the telecommunications sector, that's largely over. And now we're seeing some margin compression here as well. And so you had two things. You had the market just basically significantly downgraded its expectations for growth,
mm-hmm.
and in the process was prepared to pay a far lower multiple. So share prices came crashing down.
Yeah, totally. So for a little while, everything was, they were growing double-digit rates. They were buying up other businesses. TPG bought Ionet, Vocus bought Amcom and M2. Mm. Combination of aggregation and market growth was really, really juicing returns and helping growth until it wasn't. The aggregation's kind of done now because there's not much left to buy.
Yep.
And frankly, we're not signing up to that many more plans anymore. You know, we're all getting extra devices and signing up to home and work and iPads and Wi-Fi devices and God knows what else. That growth kind of started to slow down and potentially peter out. And TPG, when they say, look, we'll grow profit about 6%. To a market that was used to double-digit plus growth, all of a sudden that was a bit of a reckoning.
Yeah, so that, in fact, that's when we got interested, was after all of that. Mm. Kind of thought, well, geez, you know, that's actually very, we agree with that, but for the record, we think all of that is true. We think you do need to factor in lower growth. A bit above $4, we thought, yes, this is all reflected in. And then as it turned out, Vocus, having merged with M2 and Amcom, so other big telco players, very, very big bites. They had some integration problems, bit of a wobble, lowered their profit forecast and took another hit.
Yep.
So the share price held down even further. And you know, sort of around the $2.70 mark earlier this week. And then KKR come out and say, we're going to launch... not an indicative, non-binding, blah, 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 takeover offer, yep. $3.50 per share in cash.
Yes.
So what did the share price do? Well, it jumped 20%. All of a sudden, this thing is in play.
Indeed.
Now, where I wanted to get to, this is a very, very long run-up here, but what was interesting about it is this. Now, whenever you see a takeover offer, the market price pretty much corrects to that, right?
Yep. So that let's not say corrects. Let's say moves to that.
Moves to that. So you've a subtle but important difference.
Indeed.
And it makes sense, right? If this thing is going to get through at $3.50, yep. if people expect that's reasonably likely... Right. You know, there is an arbitrage opportunity there. If shares are at $2.80, you can buy at $2.80 and then sell it through the takeover off at $3.50. Boom, easy money. Money for jam.
Right. And so the share price goes up because everyone says, I'll do the same thing. No one's going to sell their shares at $2.80 because they're going to say, well, if I keep them and sell the KKR at $3.50, I'd rather do that.
But what usually happens is that there isn't, if the offer was at $3.50, you'll see the shares go to something like $3.45. or 3.46. Yep. There's a little bit of a gap there, and that little bit of a gap represents the uncertainty or allowance for the risk that the takeover offer doesn't go through. Because if it doesn't go through, shares are going to pretty much 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, fall back to where they were previously.
And a little bit of time value. So if the deal's not going to go through for another 3 or 4 months, then 3.50 in 3 or 4 months is not worth 3.50 today, because then I get no gain over that period. So 3.45 or so, okay, a bit of risk if it doesn't go through. A bit of time value of that money. Maybe I'd pay $3.45, something I get for $3.50 later.
Yep.
Because money to me now is worth more than it's worth to me then.
Yep.
So there are reasons why the shares should normally trade at some sort of discount. That discount normally represents the combination, as you say, if the risk doesn't go through. And sometimes a skeptical market will downgrade it by a lot. You might have seen the shares at $3.30, $3.35 if the market thought, well, this deal's up, but really it's not going to go through. So you know, we're playing silly buggers.
Here's the interesting thing about the Vocus one. Yesterday, when the shares closed, they were above the offer price.
$3.58.
So here's this private equity mob saying, we're going to pay $3.50 per share.
Yep.
Shares are trading now, you know, a few cents above that.
Correct.
So basically that, to me at least, and I'll welcome your interpretation, but it says to me that the market is expecting another higher bid to come through.
Correct. That's exactly what it is. In fact, either a higher bid from the same company or potentially a competing bid that might just, if the market's lucky, start a bidding war.
I frankly think the bid does undervalue the business. I think it's worth a lot more. Here's the other interesting thing about it. So the market prior to this bid said, well, we think Vocus is worth, let's call it $2.80 per share. That's what the business is worth.
Yep.
A private equity, it doesn't matter who they are. Someone else has come out and said, no, we think it's worth $3.50.
Yes.
And then the market's gone, oh yeah, it must be. and it's sort of come up to this sort of level. In fact, now it's worth more, and then people are talking about, well, they could sell some of these assets, they could do this, they could do that, and realize all this extra value. How has it changed, though? I mean, isn't that potential, wasn't that always there? So the argument that people are making, it why it's worth more than $350, couldn't have you made that when it was at $270? Okay, you needed a force for change, and maybe you needed different hands on the wheel, or maybe you need different ownerships, or whatever it happened to be. But that was always there. And if this is an obvious low-hanging fruit or an easy-to-prosecute type of strategy, what – riddle me that. How does that make sense?
I think, Andrew, you are trying to compare apples and oranges to some degree.
Okay, okay.
The reality is the market writ large thought the company was worth $280. In fact, if anyone was wanting to pay more than $280 for the shares, they would have, and the share price would have gone up.
Right.
So all the market participants that are prepared to make a bid – we're only going to pay $280 because, frankly, you don't want to pay more than you have to. So why would you pay $3? If someone's going to sell you shares at $280, you'll pay as little as you need to buy what you want.
Sure.
On the flip side, you've then got – so that's the market deciding the intrinsic or underlying value, or at least the perceived value of that company. Yeah. What I think it's worth is $280, for example, if I was in the market at that point.
Yeah.
You're not then saying it's now worth $350. What you're saying is someone else will pay me $350 if I hold the shares. So that's a very different scenario. This entire arbitrage between the previous price and the current price says – there might just be someone in the market prepared to pay me a larger amount for those shares, so I'm not going to sell them cheaper.
But KKR is saying it's worth it. For us, we can pay $3.50 and still realize a whole bunch of value.
Well, not necessarily. And this is oh, you mean KKR.
KKR, right.
And that's where it's different. So that's just the opinion of two different groups.
Mm.
So just because KKR thinks it's right doesn't mean anyone else might necessarily think it's right. The market at large thinks it's right.
Yeah,
the market's just saying, I can get that from someone who's prepared to pay me for it. If I had a car worth
$15,000.
I think
it just legitimizes that perception of value to some extent. One, it's because, well, there's just someone there for whatever reason, crazy or otherwise, who's prepared to pay it. But the fact that the price has now gone above that and there's expectation for higher bids and that a lot of people in the market are saying, it undervalues it. It's more that, for me, it's that... this narrative that's going around every talking head on the telly and in the financial press saying, it's clearly undervalued, it's clearly worth more. And it's like, well, if it's so clearly the case, why wasn't that reflected in the price? And I'm not talking about something that's 2 or 3% different, but rather something's 20, 25% different.
Because the talking heads are saying now who weren't saying it 2 weeks ago are talking out of their backsides.
Right, okay, this is
what the Latin scholars would call post-fact, something like that. Let's not talk Latin, let's talk English. after the fact, justification.
Yeah,
of course it's worth more than that. Well, mate, if you think it's worth $350, $360, $370, you weren't loading up at $280.
You should have been backing
then,
the truck
right,
up, right?
Then you're talking complete crap. So, is it worth more than that? Possibly. Andrew, you already thought it was, which is great, and you made a recommendation. Other people said, no, it's not.
Definitely
making a recommendation.
Worth more than
$350. Yep. The question simply is, the market's paying $350 now only because they think someone else is interested, someone else is going to offer them that, and maybe a bit more.
Mm.
So this is pure, this is speculation with a capital S, right? Because
if
this doesn't go ahead, the share price will absolutely fall back. If both parties walk away from this, say, no, we don't want to do the deal, the market might keep some of the halo effect to your point and say, well, okay, maybe it's worth more than $280, fair enough. We've seen someone else express a really strong desire and put their own money up. So maybe there's some justification, something worth something like that.
Yep.
But if people already thought it was worth that, they should have been buying all the way out from $280 to something close to $350, if that's what they genuinely think it's now worth.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are speculating, well, you can spin this off, sell this, whatever. Well, that was always possible.
Yeah.
And so to say now all of a sudden it's possible is really just people piggybacking on KKR saying, well, if they think so, then maybe I think so.
Legitimizing the argument.
It's lazy thinking, quite frankly.
So we have to tie this in a knot
here. Really should.
So let's bring this down to a practical end point here.
Yes.
If you are an existing holder of Vocus shares, you're very thankful of that 20-25% gain that you've seen recently.
Indeed.
I know we are very thankful for it.
Congratulations.
But what should you do? Do you take the bird in the hand and say, hurrah, I'll take that?
Yep.
Or do you say, well, I might be able to get a little bit of extra money here through a higher bid? Or frankly, I just think the business is worth much more than that, and in time that value will be reflected. What is your advice?
Depends entirely on what you think the business is actually worth in the first place. And this is where you've got to strip away the entire market expectation, market view, whatever, and really be independent and think independently.
So don't worry about speculating on further takeover offers and the rest of it. It's just, what's this thing independently worth?
Right.
And if you think it's worth more than $350, then hold, and if not, sell.
Right. And so frankly, if you bought it $280, think it was worth something more than that, and you would offer 20% more in the space of a couple of weeks or a month, and you're not sure whether it's worth more than this, and take the money. There is free money on the table for you right now at $350 for the 57. You can sell those shares right now, pocket the change, and there's no risk of the bid falling over and downside.
Yeah, you might kick yourself if $3.80 comes out of the woodwork down the track, but it's,
but relative to what you've already got, you've got, 70 cents from $280 to $350.
Yeah.
In terms of risk reward, if it was me, I would. If you didn't think it's worth more than this and you're happy with the gain, take the money and walk away. Yep. If you always thought it was worth $4 or $4.50, then feel free to keep your shares and wait and see what happens, bearing in mind that in the short term, if the deal doesn't go ahead, shares may fall back to $3 for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have to wait longer to see that value recognized. That's the reality of these takeover bids. We've seen, you know, the likes of, you know, plenty of companies in the past, there's too many to name, quite frankly, but those who had this takeover rumored, DJs back in the day, takeover rumored, fell away, shares fell back. If you think it's worth more in the long term, by all means hold the shares, but just be prepared for that volatility. And if you put your mindset on $4, $4.50, $5, then by all means wait for that. But bear in mind that you might see some declines if the takeover doesn't go ahead in the meantime.
Yeah, I'd echo that. For what it's worth, our advice has been like, you know, don't sell your shares at this point in time. We think you should continue to hold on to them. We think it's worth more than $3.50. If it falls through, we think that value will be recognized in time. Vocus has some incredibly wonderful, durable, long-lived assets, and we think a pretty decent industry tailwind there. And so the stumbles that they've had in terms of integration are very disappointing, but they are not long term in nature. They will be resolved one way or the other, we think, in time. And in 5 years' time, this is all going to be a distant memory, and the shares are going to be worth a lot more, in my view. So we think it's a mistake to sell, and we're glad to sort of see this catalyst, for want of a better term, that sort of helped the market recognize a bit more of that value. Having said that, I would not, if you're not a shareholder, rush to come in, buy in now on speculation of a higher takeover bid. I think that's just a little bit dangerous, but it's your money, and just remember that you're taking a punt if you're doing that. Mate, we have gone over the 30-minute mark, which for us is dramatically over time. Thank you, as always, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Page.
And to our listeners, of course, as well. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast
on
iTunes, and you should, and your favorite Android podcast app. If you like what we're doing, we hope you do, please give us a nice 5-star rating there as well. But until next week, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under financial services license 400691.